This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink On Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we explore what sexual lubricants can interfere with fertility, plus how to enlist the community to promote good health. But first, how an artful photojournalist captures some emotion-filled and private moments on film. Well, we all agree that a picture is worth a thousand words. We've all seen those iconic images that say it all. And these days, video, too, can powerfully capture and tell stories. Well, here with more on this is Ross Taylor, an award-winning veteran photojournalist who's been engaged in this type of storytelling for over 20 years. Welcome, Ross. Thanks for coming in.
Great. Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Ross, tell us about yourself. Your work, I mean, I understand that you literally have won or been nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, and you won a National Photographer of the Year Award. Tell us about yourself, what you've been doing, and how you got into photojournalism.
Well, I've been doing photojournalism about 20 years now. It started after college. I attended the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and I studied photojournalism there. And I knew that I wanted to tell stories, but I had no idea where all of this would end up. So for me, in many ways, it's been a series of peeking around the corner. And the more I did this, the more I guess life was revealed to me through photography. And I don't think that I set out to have a 20-year career. In fact, I thought I would do it for maybe 5 or 10 years and explore other options. But the more I did it, the more fascinating life became, the more I was able to be a part of and to witness. And that led to a 20-year career in photojournalism, working primarily with newspapers, but also freelance in various countries outside of America as well.
Now, when you began this, you said you went to college for it. When you were younger, what moved you to want to capture images? Because that is always fascinating. I happen to be a photographer as well, so I'm curious as to what drew you to want to capture the moment, so to speak.
Sure.
Did you have any people that were your icons or your
my dad.
Oh.
My dad had a dark room in our utility closet in our house in Mint Hill, North Carolina. And so he was he had a little tiny side business where he would take pictures of athletics in the community to kind of fund his hobby. So he introduced it to me in high school, and I wanted to spend time with my dad.
Wow. Well, that's a good reason.
Yeah, what kid doesn't? And so we spent time in the closet together, in the utility closet, and I learned the skills, and I found it intriguing, and never really thought about it as a career, though, until I got to school and saw that it was an option. In fact, the real reason I got into photography is I wanted to be a writer, but I couldn't get into the creative writing program, and they said, why don't you go try the journalism school? And so I transitioned to the journalism school, and that's when I discovered that you could do this as a career.
And what's interesting is, as I said in the beginning, a picture is worth a thousand words. In a way, what you can capture in an image, a moment in time, can really say so much, in some ways more than writing paragraphs on it.
That's right. And there's a power of lingering in what's called the moment in photography, and there's a power of the extended gaze and how we connect with the human experience through that extended gaze, which is captured in photography in ways that are unlike other forms of media.
Well, I had the opportunity to look at some of your work, which is really stunning. And I see that you've really focused on humanitarian issues, emotional crises, moments in people's lives that are very, very moving. How did you get into that whole world? I mean, some photographers will be content doing stills still lives or landscapes. I mean, what moved you to the human condition?
I think that's what I was alluding to in the sense, excuse me, about earlier on, I wouldn't have said that I started out to do that, but through peeking around the corner, so to speak, metaphorically, the more I did this, the more it became apparent to me these issues that you mentioned. I never even thought that I could access them, and so the more I became introduced to these issues of, as you said, the humanitarian condition, it intrigued me, and I wanted to explore it more bit by bit. So the more I did this, the more I saw, the more influential it was in my life. And I would say that I didn't even know that this was possible, this type of work was possible. And in many ways, I didn't even know these kinds of conditions of life were even in existence.
Tell us about some of the places you've been, just to help us understand or visualize some of the things you've done.
So I've worked in Iraq and Afghanistan in the past few years. I've photographed I documented the largest trauma hospital in Afghanistan, in Kandahar. It's called the Role 3 Trauma Hospital. And then we did several embeds as well in Iraq during the drawdown time. We worked with the Riverines, which is a unit that patrols the Iraq-Iran border. One of our embeds was with them. We did another embed in the explosives ordnance disposal unit, and this is a unit that, if you've seen the movie The Hurt Locker, it's sure. based on that. We did another embed in the Virginia National Guard and a transport team. So we did work on convoy missions in Iraq.
So you were really basically in conflict areas where you were seeing. You were seeing damages to the human spirit as well as the human body.
Sure. Clearly most extensively in Afghanistan, because it's a daily onslaught of casualties of war.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Ross Taylor, photojournalist for over 20 years, and we're talking about his work and his inspiration for his work. So, do you ever feel, because I know I've struggled with this myself as a photographer, do you ever feel like a voyeur in terms of you're in a very poignant moment in someone's life, perhaps, seeing them in a potentially very vulnerable position? How does that affect you, and how does it either enhance what you capture or limit how you capture it?
I view my photography as an extension of how I build relationships. And so I view the communication of photography more from a relationship basis. And why I think that's important is I don't view it as so much as a voyeur, because I'm engaged with people's lives. I want to know their experience. I want to understand. I don't want to just listen, but I want to hear. And I think there's a big difference. And so you build a relationship upon hearing a person's position in life, and then the photography happens for me, and then the visual exchange happens. I don't photograph from a distance, and I don't typically engage with photography that's from far away. I want to be close with people, and I want to hear them. So the photography is an extension of that relationship, and almost always has an effect on me.
Yeah, and I guess the one question I would have is, what role, if any, and this will actually segue into what we're going to talk about coming up, some of your recent projects, but does the whole notion of compassion have when you are engaged in this? I mean, does it either bring forth your own sense of compassion? Tell us about that.
I think the photography has made me a better person. In fact, I know it has, because in order to tell the kind of stories or to engage with the kinds of situations that I have, you have to be compassionate. You have to have that. So it's made me be more compassionate, because I want to connect with people on that level.
And do you think that really is reflected in your work, or it's almost an essential part of your work?
Right.
In terms of the end product.
I do. I don't think I'm necessarily technically an amazing photographer, but I think the difference is that I'm a relationship-oriented photographer, and the intensity of the relationships are reflected in the work.
So you recently went back to school. Tell
us
about that. That must have been interesting.
That's right. I'm 42, and I'm now that older person on campus at UMC.
Mm-hmm.
So I've decided to come back. I wanted to learn film production, rooted in a journalistic or storytelling tradition.
So just let me interrupt. Before that, you've basically been using still photography.
That's right. Only still photography for the most part. I was lucky enough to get a fellowship at Syracuse University in the Newhouse Multimedia Photography and Design Department under the leadership of Bruce Strong. And so now I'm here on a one-year program getting a master's teaching as well as studying film production and storytelling.
How is that different from telling the stories one image at a time?
It's very different. And I was wrong in assuming that it would be similar. Photography for me was more about identifying a key moment in time that would illustrate a person's experience. And storytelling, I find it, at least where I am right now, much more complex in the sense of, or film is much more complex in the sense that you're keying in on not just audio, not just video, but you're also keying in how do you tell a story within a certain amount of time. And that's a different venue, almost a different medium.
What are you hoping to accomplish, though, in that? I mean, is this just an expansion of the kind of work you've been doing, or do you have something in mind specifically when you decided to take on this whole new project?
I think more in terms of a theoretical approach, in the sense that what I want to accomplish is a more robust form of storytelling. And I think this may be, at least for me and where I'm at, I want to hear people more. And I think film production gives a chance for us to hear people in ways that photography.
So you add that whole auditory piece. Right. In a sense, it's more living. It's more of a living document, in a sense.
Right.
So now you have been doing some projects here at the Upstate University Hospital, at Upstate Medical University. Tell us about those projects. What have you been doing?
I've done a number of things. Ranging from stories of people with a child who was fighting cancer, to a kidney transplant, to most recently we're doing a lot of films in the burn unit.
And those are obviously very, very emotional and poignant moments in these people's lives.
Right.
So is your tell us what your goal is.
That's our goal is to, I'm producing six films in the burn unit, and we're hoping to publish them on a website that is a resource for burn victims and their families.
So that it's telling their story as a source of potential inspiration to others? Is that something?
To others, but also to the community, those who are affected by burns.
Wow. Well, I just want to mention that your work will be on our website. That's healthlinkonair, all one word, .org. And if anyone's interested in seeing some of these videos, they certainly can find them on our website. Do any of these images haunt you? I'm curious. I mean, you're obviously doing some very profound, personal, and very evocative things in people's lives. Do you ever find that they haunt you?
They stay with you, for sure. You can't see some things in anybody in that position, I'm sure, has a similar experience.
And how about your relationships going forward with these people? Obviously, you've had some relationship. Is that an important thing to maintain?
When possible, yes. I always try to do that.
Wow. Well, I applaud you. It's wonderful work. Very,
thanks.
Very meaningful work. I can just say that I found many of your images really heart-wrenching and haunting as well. So thank you so much for coming in. My guest has been Ross Taylor. He's an award-winning photojournalist and filmmaker now, and he's joined us today to tell us about his work. Thanks so much again.
Thank you, too.
Keep up the good work. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Next up, how some sexual lubricants can interfere with fertility. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. In the U.S. today, reproductive and fertility problems appear to be on the rise, and there is increasing concern that environmental contaminants may be harming the reproductive health and fertility of women and men. But a new study has shed some light on a surprising new source for fertility problems. And here with more on this is Dr. Renee Mestad, Assistant Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology, and Dr. Kazim Chohan, Professor of Pathology, Obstetrics, and Gynecology, and the Director of the Andrology Lab at Upstate Medical University. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Appreciate
Thank you.
Your being here. So, Dr. Chohan, let me start with you. You recently completed a study that was looking at sexual lubricants with some surprising results. Can you tell us about it?
Well, this study started interestingly with few students were rotating through my lab, as you said, andrology lab. We diagnosed patients with fertility problems there. And one of the patients asked for a lubricant, and the student asked, is this lubricant sperm friendly? That initiated the study, and then we completed a study on all possible lubricants we could study.
So your goal, just to interrupt you, your goal was to take a look at sexual lubricants to see if they were potentially sperm friendly or potentially sperm harming.
You are absolutely right. And we studied all these commercial lubricants available at different stores, and including like Preseed, Astroglide, KY lubricants. And we also
those are the commercial names.
Yes.
Preseed, Astroglide, and any of those commercial
KY products, like KY warming, KY tingling. These are player boosting sexual lubricants. And we also studied few common oils, maybe which are available in your pantry.
So household products.
Household products
that are oils that could be used. Yeah. Give me some examples.
We looked at their impact on sperm motility.
On how the sperm can swim, how actively they can function.
And interestingly, what we found that all these commercial coital lubricants, except Preseed, they were all spermicidal.
Wow.
And like KY products, like warming and tingling, they just kill sperm on contact.
Wow.
So if a couple is using them for coital lubricant, the possibility are they may not conceive.
Wow.
So these are like spermicidal lubricants.
Dr. Mistad, tell me when and how. I mean, obviously for just common usage, someone might choose to use sexual lubricant during sexual intercourse or activity. But there are specific times that people are using it even during an attempt to get pregnant.
Yes. Sexual lubricants are actually pretty commonly used. Most women find that they have about 5 minutes worth of self-lubrication, so if they're going to have intercourse for any time longer than that, they're going to find it's actually painful and very uncomfortable, which dissuades them from wanting to have sex in the first place. Additionally, there are some women who are having difficulty conceiving who part of the reason they're having difficulty is their fluid balances aren't correct. They aren't normal. And so therefore, their cervical mucus and other fluids inside their vagina that help to move sperm up into the uterus don't work as well either.
So do they also experience more vaginal dryness, for example?
Exactly, because this affects their own self-lubrication. And so they will use store-bought lubricants to help make sex not be quite as painful.
And also, are there other examples of when these are used during certain kinds of fertility, either fertility treatments or, you know, exploration of what the fertility issues might be?
Additionally, men will use them when they're producing a semen sample to either be used for study to see whether or not their sperm work well, or to give the sample for other treatments like intrauterine insemination or in vitro fertilization.
Are they also used, for example, to help with the insertion of certain medical devices and that kind of thing?
Yes, they are. Speculums are very uncomfortable for a lot of women, and so various lubricants are utilized by the physician to insert the speculum.
It's striking to me, though, Dr. Chohan, that you would think that these lubricants that are marketed would have been tested for this very thing. And it sounds to me like you were the first study to really look at the potential spermicidal characteristics. Is that true?
That's not true, actually. A few other studies have been published on the same area, but we are the first one to study the impact of these KY-sensitive warming and tingling. Every day, new products are introduced into the market. So my feeling is in future, you are going to see more studies on the same aspect. Few more researchers will study like future lubricants on that. But we also added some like common oils in that.
What common oils
like
we mentioned?
Canola oil, baby oil, sesame oil, and mustard oil. Some of may look very strange to you, but we found out that these coital lubricants were sperm friendly, like canola oil, baby oil were sperm friendly. They the sperm motility remained the same almost over 1 hour compared to the control. And to our interest, mustard oil gave us really good results. It enhanced the sperm motility, and this needs to be studied further if there is any positive impact of mustard oil on that.
That's kind of a striking result, because to actually find something that would enhance the motility of sperm, that's a commonly occurring, you know, non-manufactured product, would seem so simple and yet could possibly have striking and dramatic results. What do you think about that, Dr. Mystic?
I think it's very interesting and very exciting. I'm kind of hope that Dr. Chohan's going to pursue this, or someone in his lab will, because it will make a big difference for a lot of our patients. Additionally, you know, many women and couples have these oils in their pantries. What they do need to understand is they only need a small amount. The advantage to oil-based lubricants is that they do last much longer, don't tend to evaporate the way the water-based lubricants do. They also can be a little bit messy, but women just need a small amount, or men just need to use a very small amount.
Would the hope be, I know that mustard oil currently in its current form for food as a food additive, or as you have mentioned, in India and Pakistan, it's used as a general skin lubricant.
Yes.
But it has a certain odor attached to it. So would you hope that this could be purified and used?
Absolutely. If we find good results with that, maybe in future some sperm wash mediums and all that, it may be used to like enhance the sperm motility in patients who are having poor motility. We don't know, but we are going to pursue this because it showed us interesting results. And it opens up some channels on the sperm which activates them. And it keeps them moving. So that's an interest for us, and we are going to continue our study on that.
If you're just listening to us and joining us, this is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, here with Drs. Chohan and Mestad, and we're talking about the potential negative effects of certain sexual lubricants on fertility. I think it's important to note here, though, that even though some of these might slow down a sperm or make it less active, you wouldn't recommend any of these to be used as a primary source for preventing conception.
Yes. Now that we have said all of this, that various lubricants can impede the activity of sperm, couples should not use things like Astroglide or KY jelly, assuming that they will keep them from getting pregnant. They do need to use an additional method of contraception.
So that's obviously not sufficient, or hasn't been proved to really prevent fertility.
Yes.
What it does is clearly, if you're having other fertility issues, it can add to or complicate the whole process. Tell us how you decided to use the various things that you did. I mean, in terms of studying this process.
Well, it started, as I previously told you, it started in an interesting way that I had a student, one from India. He wanted to study oils from his part of the world. Then I have a Chinese student. He came up, he said, Dr. Chohan, I want to study sesame oil, which we use for in China.
So your student from India decided to do mustard seed oil.
And the Chinese wanted to add sesame oil in that. And we looked like a couple of other lubricants too, shea butter and all that. But we ended up with few of them which are commonly used. And that was exciting for us to complete this study.
Exactly what did you do? Just very briefly, give us an overview of how you achieved these results.
Well, we aliquoted the washed sperm, and we made our control as a human tubal fluid, which is exactly the human tubal fluid we're having.
So
you got
human sperm?
Yes, we washed them in human tubal fluid, which is exactly the same, having the same basic salts and everything like a female will have in her fallopian tubes. That was our control. Then we introduced these quite lubricants into sperm and human tubal fluid with 10% consistency, which is we calculated that this is the consistency a female will have during an intercourse. And we incubated them over 1 hour period of time. And we checked motility before we started the experiment, then just on contact in 5 minutes, then at 30 minutes, and then at 60-minute interval.
How did the mustard seed oil stack up? I mean, did it last for the full 60 minutes?
It we ended the study at 60 minutes, but we continued to watch them over four-hour period of time, and the sperm were consistently hyperactive.
Wow.
And so we want to do more studies on that. It's interesting
like,
results
it
for
sounds
us.
Like a very key element of your study to find
yes.
out, especially with so much infertility. What are some of the other things, Dr. Mistad, that can actually cause infertility in terms of environmental types of things or health types of things?
So when a woman decides that she wants to get pregnant, one of the first things she needs to do is, if she's a smoker, stop smoking. Smoking has been demonstrated repeatedly to interfere with ovulation, with the fallopian tube, ability for the egg to move through the fallopian tube to meet the sperm. It affects implantation. It increases the risk of miscarriage and subsequently can also increase the risk of preterm delivery, growth restriction, which means that the baby is small, and a smaller baby is a weaker baby. So it's very, very important that the woman stop smoking before she becomes pregnant. Waiting until she finds out she is pregnant is too late. Additionally, she needs to start prenatal vitamins as soon as she decides she's pregnant, not when she finds out she's pregnant. The folic acid in prenatal vitamins helps to prevent various birth defects, and it does its most work in the first 4 to 6 weeks of pregnancy. Most women don't find out they're pregnant until as soon as 6 to 8 weeks, so they've lost that window to prevent a lot of birth defects.
So if you're actually engaged in family planning and you think and you're attempting actively to become pregnant, these are some of the steps.
Exactly.
What other things do you find, though, that could be a hazard to fertility?
Common medications like nonsteroidals, like Motrin, Advil, ibuprofen, Aleve, those kind of medications. Additionally, antihistamines and allergy medications.
Really?
Claritins, Benadryls, medications like that, decongestants, your Sudafeds. Therefore, your cold and flu medications can also affect.
So what's the takeaway if you're saying to someone out there who's thinking about getting pregnant, what should they do or not do?
They need to talk to their doctor, particularly if they have other health problems and are taking other medications for health conditions that can interfere with pregnancy as well. They need to talk to their doctor. They need to plan their pregnancy.
Well, this is very interesting information. Thank you so much for coming in. My guests have been Dr. Renee Mested, who is the Associate Assistant Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology, and Dr. Kazim Chohan, Professor of Pathology, Obstetrics, and Gynecology, and the Director of the Andrology Lab at Upstate Medical University. Thanks so much. Very important work. I hope you find out more about mustard seed oil.
Thank you.
Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now for our checkup from the neck up from our resident psychologist, Rich O'Neill.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's checkup from the neck up, death and taxes. Well, folks, a few years or decades ago, one of my then young sons was whining to a friend about some reason / excuse for not doing something that seemed like a no-brainer to her. She then made one of the most sophisticated psychological interventions I've ever heard. She said, "Oh, get over it." I love that. Now, I bet you felt left out sometime in your life. Not invited to the best party, picked for the good team, selected by the cool frat. How would you like to be a member of a very select club that people are dying to get into, and you can pick yourself to be a member? Would you take 5 minutes of your time to make it happen? And it's free? And it would make someone else or even a bunch of people feel a whole lot better for a long time and maybe even save their lives? You think I'm kidding? Nope. Game? Okay. Step one, reach into your wallet. Take out your driver's license, flip it over, and if you're like me, put on your reading glasses, then read and check the little box that says, "I hereby make an anatomical gift," and put your John or Jill Hancock next to it. Now, I've heard that there are over 120,000 people nationwide who need a heart, kidney, liver, and a lot who need other stuff like corneas, bone, skin, including women needing skin for reconstruction after having a breast removed. And I just heard there are only about 8,000 of us who give up the good stuff after giving up the ghost every year. Pretty select club, huh? No dues, remember. Here are some reasons, excuses we have for not checking and signing, and the realities I found out when I talked with an expert. We think, I've got this or that physical problem. They won't want me. Not to worry about that one. The doctors decide. Or we think, I'm too old or too young. Nah, no age discrimination. The doctors decide. Or if I'm in an accident and in the ER unconscious, they'll read my license, want my organs more than they want to help me, and let me die. Nope. Dr. Frankenstein only works at the ER in the movies. Or we don't even want to think about dying for a second, let alone 5 minutes. Right, of course. So instead of thinking about dying, think about your gift being the best you ever gave. You don't have to go shopping, and you don't even have to wrap it, and there's no credit card bill. Free! My own personal before checking and signing hang-up was that I thought I'd look weird in my coffin if I gave somebody my eyes and freak out my family. Of course, not true. They make sure you look great. And my kids told me when I talked to them about this, we're going to put a paper bag over your head like we've been hoping you'd do for years anyway. And I remembered that I wanted to be cremated afterwards anyway. Weird how the brain works, huh? Speaking of beloved families, step two in making someone very happy, or up to about 50 people if you go for the whole body makeover, is talking with your loved ones about what you want to donate, so they don't even have to think about it before they start arguing about who gets the car or the jewelry or the money, etc. Speaking of money, think about it this way. A part of you can live on and not pay any taxes. Still haven't signed and had the chat? Get over it! You'll be dead! I'm Dr. Rich O'Neill. Thanks for tuning in.
If you want to sign up for organ donation, you can go to the New York State Department of Health website and download the healthcare proxy form that has a section for organ donation. We'll put the web address on our website. Or you can go to organdonor.gov. Coming up next, how to enlist one's community to promote good health. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Dr. Donna Bakke, Chair of Public Health and Preventive Medicine, with your Healthy Monday Minute from March 17th. Don't postpone your physical. Periodic health checkups and screenings with your healthcare provider are key to maximizing your chance of living a longer and healthier life. Not only can they help prevent health problems before they start, but checkups may also help you discover health problems early enough to increase your chances of successful treatment and recovery. The specific screenings and exams you need depend on your age, health, family history, and lifestyle choices such as diet, exercise, smoking, etc. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Stroke. It's the leading cause of death in the United States, killing nearly 130,000 Americans each year. That's one in every 19 deaths. And now, there's a new recommendation from the American Academy of Neurology regarding prevention. And here with me to tell us more about it is the lead author of that updated guideline. Dr. Antonio Calabres, he's professor of neurology at Upstate Medical University and a fellow of the American Academy of Neurology. Welcome, Dr. Calabres. Thanks
for coming. Pleasure to be here.
So you've just published a new guideline for stroke prevention. I think it was in the February issue of the medical journal called Neurology. Can you tell us about it?
That is correct. This is an updated guideline on the prevention of cardioembolic stroke in patients with atrial fibrillation. Since the last publication by the American Academy of Neurology in 1998 on the same topic, there have been many new and very exciting developments. Among other things, there are three new agents, oral anticoagulants for the prevention of stroke in patients with atrial fibrillation that are very effective and very safe. The guideline addresses these new medications.
So let me stop you there and ask you, exactly what is the new guideline, if you can state it in a sentence?
The new guideline has two main chapters. The first chapter is identification of atrial fibrillation in patients with what we call cryptogenic stroke. A cryptogenic stroke is a stroke without a known cause. In many such instances, by the way, this is 25% of the strokes coming to the hospital, in many such instances, we strongly suspect that atrial fibrillation is the culprit. And that is because atrial fibrillation can come and go, paroxysmal, intermittent atrial fibrillation. And it may be difficult to identify while the patient is in the hospital. So the guideline addresses this problem by recommending the use of devices that are worn by the patient for a period of time, could be a few days, could be a few weeks, even a few months. And this is a new way of identifying atrial fibrillation. Chapter 2 of the guidelines addresses the question of what medications to administer and how we select what medications for what patient. Clearly, each patient has a different profile, and physicians need to have judgment, clinical judgment about what to administer. And the guidelines have the objective of reducing that uncertainty.
Help us understand, though, what atrial fibrillation is. I mean, it's obviously intermittent. So it comes and goes for people. Who is likely to have it, for example, and what exactly is it?
Atrial fibrillation is an irregular beat of the heart. It's an irregular rhythm. And because the rhythm is irregular, the heart can go very fast. Sometimes it goes very slow and causes symptoms such as dizziness and lightheadedness. There are times when this irregular heartbeat does not cause any symptoms. This irregular heartbeat can be intermittent, comes and goes, or can be chronic. If it's chronic and there all the time, it's easy to identify with an electrocardiogram. However, if it happens only intermittently, it may be more difficult to identify.
Hence, you want people to wear devices to try to track their, basically, their heart functioning over time. What exactly is the relationship, though, to that irregular heartbeat? How does that lead to stroke?
Because the heart doesn't beat regularly, there is a change in the circulation of blood within the heart. The blood may sit in corners of the heart for long periods of time, and that facilitates the formation of clots. These clots may migrate to the brain and plug the arteries in the brain and cause strokes.
So there is that direct relationship to an irregular heartbeat, literally causing a clot to the brain.
Yes. In fact, patients with atrial fibrillation have a high risk of having strokes, particularly if they have other risk factors, such as high blood pressure or diabetes. And if they have a history of previous strokes or TIAs, then the risk of stroke is 1 in 20.
Wow. Why did this guideline change now, though? I mean, what is different about now? You alluded to the fact that there are new medications, but is there something else going on, both in this country and worldwide, that has led us to look more aggressively or to look more aggressively and treat more aggressively atrial fibrillation?
Well, atrial fibrillation comes with age, and it's precisely people who are old or very old who have the higher incidence and prevalence of atrial fibrillation. In the past, it was a relative contraindication to give powerful oral anticoagulants to people who were old because of the fear of bleeding. Now we have studied that very closely and have determined that even though there is a higher risk of bleeding in old and very old people, the risk of having a stroke is even higher. And therefore, putting things on the balance, it is clear that it's in the best benefit of patients who are old and very old who have atrial fibrillation to consider very carefully and very strongly taking oral anticoagulants.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with neurologist Dr. Antonio Calabres, and we're talking about a new guideline for treatment to prevent strokes. Well, let me get back to that whole idea about the age factor. Isn't it true, though, that there has been almost an epidemic increase in the amount of atrial fibrillation worldwide that we're finding? Isn't that part of what's motivated this change?
Definitely. WHO has determined that 0.5% of the general population, that is 1 in 20 persons, has atrial fibrillation around the world. So clearly this is epidemic, and it's epidemic because the population is getting progressively older, and as we said before, older people have higher chances of developing atrial fibrillation.
But getting back to this notion of who gets treated, obviously what you're saying now is that more people are being encouraged to be treated, to first find the notion of diagnosing the atrial fibrillation more aggressively and then treating. What was the major limitation before in terms of age? Was there the fear of the anticoagulants, which is the main treatment for it? And let's explain that. What does the anticoagulant do?
The anticoagulants delay the clotting of the blood. And because of that, there is always a higher chance of bleeding from a little wound or from a little vessel that could be in the skin or could be in the brain. Obviously, in the skin is of no consequence, but if this happens in the brain, it could be of major consequences. So oral anticoagulants can cause hemorrhages and can cause brain hemorrhages, which is probably the worst type of bleeding that can happen. But the new oral anticoagulants have a better profile in terms of bleeding in the brain than the other more conventional anticoagulant, which is Coumadin or warfarin. So in that respect, the new oral anticoagulants are a little safer.
And I guess this whole notion of treating older people was the fear of their falling, perhaps, and thereby incurring some kind of damage to themselves, encouraging more spontaneous bleeding.
In the past, people who fell were considered to be high risk, and therefore anticoagulations were denied. But as the anticoagulations were denied, then the risk of stroke became very high. Now we know that a few falls per month or per year do not preclude the indication of taking anticoagulants. In fact, my recommendation is that if someone falls and someone needs anticoagulants, treat the falls. Do not take the patient off the anticoagulants.
That seems really essential because the stroke is the greater risk in a way. But help me understand one thing, because it was my understanding that when we talk about stroke, we're also talking about the potential of a cerebrovascular hemorrhage in the brain. So if you're giving someone a blood thinner, is there increased risk of hemorrhage, therefore? In other words, it's almost like you're walking between a rock and a hard place.
Yes, there is an increased risk of bleeding in the brain, particularly if the patient has some form of vascular malformation. If the patient has bled before, there is definitely a risk of bleeding in the brain. We use what we call stratification schemes or scales to determine the percentages of risk of having a stroke and the percentages of risk of bleeding in the brain. And these are adjuncts. They are They are useful, but we have to use them with clinical judgment.
So it's a case-by-case basis. You really have to know the patient, their entire history, all of these various factors, and then make the decision.
Yes, let me insist that these guidelines are not commandments. They are recommendations to reduce therapeutic uncertainty, to help the clinician use their judgment when indicating these medications.
I understand the World Stroke Organization has also endorsed this. So are you looking at this as going to have kind of a larger global impact?
Definitely. The American Academy of Neurology has a global reach, and these guidelines will be read not only within the United States, but outside the United States. So the World Stroke Organization has endorsed them. In fact, the guidelines contain a paragraph that is intended to be used in developing countries where there are medications that are not available in the United States that are less expensive and useful when the new oral anticoagulants, which are quite expensive, by the way, are not available. And this could be the case in 80% of countries around the world.
So what will they do? If the new anticoagulants are not available, what are the choices?
Well, the choice is to use aspirin, which is a low-level choice, or to use another medication by the name of triflusal, which has a structure similar to that of aspirin, but doesn't cause bleeding as aspirin does. And when this triflusal is used jointly with warfarin, similar drug called acenocumarol in developing countries, it could be quite useful in patients with low and moderate risk of stroke who have atrial fibrillation.
So generally, what are your hopes then for these new guidelines? Are you expecting that this will prevent stroke on a worldwide basis?
Yes, I am, and certainly I hope that these guidelines will encourage clinicians to use oral anticoagulants more widely than in the past, to be less fearful of their effects, which definitely can be negative in case of bleeding, but the good side of them, the positive side, is so much brighter. Therefore, we encourage the use of these anticoagulants in old people, very old people, people who have mild dementia, people who have falls, but not too many. And these are neuro recommendations.
Very good. Thank you so much. My guest has been Dr. Antonio Calabres, professor of neurology at Upstate Medical University and a fellow of the American Academy of Neurology. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hello, this is Deirdre Nealon, editor of The Healing Muse. Poets obviously love words, and they are very good at playing with one and spinning it into its varied meanings and possibilities. Elizabeth Crowell is a poet from Massachusetts who also teaches English literature to high school students. The title of her poem, Limbo, has both a secular and a sacred meaning. She uses both in this poignant poem about a stillborn baby. Limbo. 1. In communal auscultation, we listen to the umbilical roar as the doctor's needle navigates the womb like a beady light of a lifeboat in the night sea. Even after we understand, there is this pause as we pretend to decide it could or could not be otherwise. 2. We don't believe an unbaptized child will linger neither here nor there, but when a nurse asks in the delivery room, we agree to the cross drawn on our son's flushed head with a tight-gloved hand, wanting to give him everything he would ever have. If she had offered him a letter jacket, his brief name stitched in blue script, we would have said yes in the same way. 3. The Vatican degree, in stiff black frocks and tonic voices, pronounced limbo at best a theory and not a truth. This distinction is lost on us in the brown days that flock like pigeons snapping upward from a waterless fountain, a stone square, to settle back close to where they left, but not exactly there. 4. Grief, the exact word, swollen, bodied, is tagged on the silver utility box by the corner light we pass, moving back into traffic and weeks. Incredulous, we read it like a blessing, even as it fades, drawn over, invisible again, like the symbol sketched on the shiny flesh which we would love and never know, sunk as it is, even for us, in pentimento.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLinkOnAir, all one word, .org. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.